The fact that mother and daughter recalled two dramatically different aspects of their encounter only moments after its end suggests two possibilities. First, that one or both is an unusually poor observer, or second, that each was recalling different aspects of a longer sequence of events. Equally important to bear in mind is the focused quality of the sighting. The UFO approached from a long distance away and stopped when it was directly over them. They were for a moment apparently the center of interest, and the beam of light seemed clearly aimed at them. It isn't as if Mrs. Bennett and her daughter accidentally happened to see something passing by. Rather, it is almost as if they were the reason for the UFO's trip in the first place. When my student first told me about this sighting, I jotted down its location. Now, in looking over various Rockland County cases that might interest Harry Lynn, I was amazed to find in my notes that Mrs. Bennett lived on the Forest Lake, and that her experience took place only about a mile from the site of the McMahon-Federico abduction. I worked closely with Harry Lynn for several weeks and arranged for him to meet and interview Mrs. Bennett and a number of other UFO witnesses in Rockland County and elsewhere. Most were willing to cooperate with NBC with one nearly universal reservation. Harry put it this way: "Usually, when I do a story, everybody seems eager to be on TV. But not here, not with UFOs. No one wants his name used. I had to shoot everyone so that their faces are not visible and so on. It's really strange. They want to tell their stories. They want the information out, but they are afraid of ridicule, afraid to be recognized." Only a few witnesses, Paul Federico and Mac McMahon among them, made no special effort to have their appearance concealed. If there is a consistent false impression abroad in this area, it is that UFO witnesses as a group are publicity seekers. The opposite is more often the case. It was a cold afternoon in January when Harry Lynn, his three-man camera crew, and I drove to Snake Hill Road above De Forest Lake to film a reconstruction of the Mac McMahon, Paul Federico encounter. It was also something of a reunion of friends since Mac and Paul had not seen each other in 3 years. Through Harry's growing familiarity with the UFO case material and his discussions with Ted and me, he was aware of a range of circumstances which indicate possible abductions. He knew, of course, of the two-hour period of missing time in this particular case, but another clue dramatically surfaced that afternoon during the filming. On the way up in the car, I had mentioned that sometimes dreams contained suggestions and even partial details of forgotten abduction experiences. I had described the time in almost every abduction when the captive feels relaxed and calm, even sometimes recalling, as we have seen, waves of warmth and happiness. About a half hour later, as we stood beside Mac McMahon's car and looked out over the lake, I happened to ask Paul Federico if he remembered ever dreaming about his experience. He said that he had, but the dream was peculiar and he felt funny repeating it. I assured him that I took it very seriously, and prevailed upon him to share it. Federico spoke slowly without a trace of uncertainty or hesitation. Obviously, it had been a very clear and vivid dream. I could see an object coming down, landing, staying there for about 15 or 20 minutes, and seeing a beam of light come out, shine on the area, shine on me. And one thing I could remember that seemed very strange: I was not scared at all. I felt very relaxed, very calm, and very at ease, almost as if I was in my mother's arms as a little baby. Paul is a bespectacled, scholarly, looking man in his late 20s, and is employed by a large airline. His dream, as he retold it, was oddly touching and ingenuous. By the end of that afternoon, the experience at De Forest Lake had been revivified for Mac McMahon. Over the past several weeks, he had spent hours reviewing the details for Harry and me, going over his recollections, and thinking intensely about what had happened that night. He saw the television program as it finally appeared in three successive segments on the NBC 6 o'clock news, watching himself and Paul Federico standing at the site. A few weeks later, I called Mac to ask how he was and to inquire about his reaction to the documentary. More or less spontaneously, the wall of amnesia had begun to crumble. He told me that he and his girlfriend were driving home late one evening, when suddenly, in a rush, he said memories began flooding back. 3. He remembered the UFO landing and the beam of light shining on him exactly as Federico had dreamed it. He recalled being inside the ship and being examined by small, frightening beings. The television program had dealt extensively with the idea of abductions but without presenting any details of the UFO's interior or the examination process. A drawing of UFO occupants had been shown, but McMahon described his captives somewhat differently. There was no way anyone could connect his specific recall with what had been discussed or portrayed on the screen. There, emotion with which he described his experience was both familiar to me and unmistakably genuine. Many details of his account will be familiar by now to the reader. Above all, it must be borne in mind that McMahon reported these details to me in March of 1979, months before Stephen Kilburn, Howard Rich, or David Oldham described their on-board examinations. I asked Mac McMahon if the table he was on had been metal. No. Formica sort of top, whitish top, rim around the outside, very similar to a counter, but it was in the center of the floor. It was either the center or my head was up against the wall, and my feet sticking into the middle of the floor. The wall across from my body, across from me, would have been roughly 6 feet from the end of the table. And I'm 6 feet tall, so I'd say the room was 12 feet across. B.H. How about height? How high was it? Pause. No general impression of height. B.H. How was the light in the room? Light seemed to come from behind me and up above. B.H. Do you remember seeing a light source? No. The room was well lit. There was a light on me from behind and it was like a lamp, it felt like a lamp. The light was like a light bulb behind me and up above. B.H. Though you couldn't see it? No. 45 degrees up from my belt. Light directly above my head. B.H. Though you never did actually see it, you just felt a source there. Yes, there was a source of light there. B.H. How was the room shaped? First impression is circular, but I doubt it. B.H. And these figures? You said there were three of them along the wall, against a flat wall. That's why I say it was not circular. B.H. How far were they from the table? They were up against the wall, from my feet, 6 feet. One was right at my right hip, and bent and looked into my face. B.H. Any sense of the eyes? Yeah, black eyes. Big eyes. Yeah? Very calm. Very calm. B.H. Any communication? No. There might have been, but I don't think so. There was none to me directly. I felt like I was being regarded as an animal. B.H. And you said they were just compassionless, just, no feelings. The doctor one, peered into my face. I mean, peered, stared intently. And I mean, the eyes were. He seemed to gauge emotion from my contact. And it was much more steady, intent, I mean, very, very intense gaze. And it was right into my face, right into my eyes. And they were not hypnotic or anything like that, and I was able to look back and scour the face, and the drawing at the end of that show. That fits. That fits a lot of it together. B.H., you said the figures had this grayish skin. Yeah? Pale. Very pale. B.H., what about the texture of the skin? Did it look like our skin? Couldn't. I first thought plastic, but I doubt that. I really don't have any faith in that word. It's like trying to describe red to a blind man. Hard. Harder skin. The fingertips felt more firm than ours. And they were on my shoulder, I know that, just below my, no. I had a T-shirt on, and that would be ridiculous for that time of the year, and it would have been on the forearm where my tattoo is on my left arm, on the muscle itself, on the rear of the arm. The fingertips grabbed me the, I remember that. BH, and you said you were struggling. Were you really struggling? Were you able to? It seemed like a dream sequence. That's what it seemed like. It seemed like a dream sequence. It didn't quite come out altogether. It didn't register well, I know that. BH, any sense of clothing on these figures?
Clothes?
Yeah, they were dressed. BH, you said that one guy had on a sort of medical outfit. That's what it reminded me of. Maybe that's because of the way he examined me. I'd say it was hard to describe. It would have been a snap-high collar, like you see on the old doctor shows. BH, sort of a turtleneck.
Yeah?
The other ones wore more of a coverall, grayish-green, darker than their skin, but along the same skin lines. More form, fitting. And they were built well. They were built powerfully. I remember that. BH, they weren't weak, looking.
No.
They weren't weak, looking at all. They looked like miniature people, but there were no skinny arms and all that crap. They were built as normal as a person would be. That's what it seemed to me. They didn't seem extra thin. They seemed normal, only 5 feet tall. BH, but their faces were, how about the relation of head to body? The face seemed bigger and the head seemed more round, and maybe a little bit larger, but human. BH, but they definitely had shoulders, and a build.
Yeah, they had a build.
Definitely a build, definitely a structure, and I would say skeletally they were similar to us. BH, incidentally, did these images come back from time to time or did they all come in a rush one time?
That night they came in a rush. I was almost in tears. That was about 2 weeks ago.
I told Teresa. I just started remembering a lot of stuff, and I started talking to her, and I almost went to tears. I almost went to pieces. I was driving the car and talking and everything was just flowing out, and I'm almost in tears, and I started to shake. When I'm driving the car, I do a lot of things that are automatic, like driving home, especially at night. When I'm a little tired, I can drive and talk, and I'm in a different zone. I shut off everything except for that. BH, Mac, would you mind if I talked to Teresa about this?
Number. BH, you understand. I'd like to get her recollections of this.
Sure.
Definitely.
Verification. You've got to have it. BH, do you remember any physical pain?
No.
A sense of numbness. That is definitely remembered. Except, there was no pain. I felt normal, except I don't remember the actual thing that happened. I do know something happened. It felt like I was being ripped to pieces, and put back together again, and I can tell you that, though there was no pain accompanying that memory. So I'm saying that because of what I think was done to me would have caused pain in any other situation. I just had a hypodermic injection in the foot cause I've got calluses. I can't stand that. That drives me completely up the wall. My tolerance is low. But I did notice my reaction. I did take note of it in a part of my head that I wasn't conscious of until later. But when it started coming out in a panic, that things were happening. And as soon as I told them I was listening to myself, and accepted that, the panic was gone. BH. Did you notice any communication between them? Any sounds at all?
I hate saying this, it seems as if they moved and talked without speaking, and that's one idea I just don't like, but they seemed to talk without speaking.
Maybe they were talking, but I don't think so. I thought of hand signals. Enforced silence. They could talk if they wanted to, but they didn't choose to. You don't want a chimp to know that you can talk, so you don't talk in front of the chimp. It wasn't an anti-human attitude, it was more of a we're going to check you out, pup. Get up there on the table sort of a deal. I get the same impression when I take a dog to the vet. Maybe that's what's bothering me, cause we used to own a kennel. That's the sort of impression I got from these people. Hi, pup, get up on the table here. Sit down, don't wet yourself. Mac McMahon's account is rich in observations.
both visual and psychological. His description of feeling like a dog on a veterinarian's table is remarkably similar to Barney Hill's remark that he felt exactly like a hunted rabbit he had once seen, motionless and terrified, falsely believing it could somehow escape. For I felt like a worm on a hook, McMahon said to me later. Other memories were equally specific. His sense of their behavior is exactly like that which Stephen Kilburn reported months later. They were as compassionless as possible. Their attitude was completely utilitarian. They did exactly what they had to. Mac's description of their physical appearance is worth investigation. He had seen on the television documentary a drawing made from Stephen Kilburn's description of his captives. McMahon said that though the head in this drawing reminded him very much of what he had seen, the bodies were different. They were built well. They were built powerfully. They weren't weak-looking at all. There were no skinny arms. They didn't seem extra thin. The fact that McMahon accepted only the facial image of Kilburn's reconstruction and firmly rejected the skinny, attenuated body, is evidence that he was not unduly influenced by what he had seen on television. His description presents a variant on a standard humanoid type. Figure 5 in the illustration section is a sketch of one of Kilburn's abductors. Figure 6 is a drawing made by Betty Andreessen of one of her captors in a 1967 incident. Though the faces are similar, the bodies conform to the two different types. Her drawing had not been published when McMahon described virtually the same type. He also reported that the figures were 4 and a half to 4 and 3 quarters feet tall, though the doctor was taller, about 5 feet. Andreessen also described the leader in her encounter as being taller than the 4 and a half feet average of the rest of the crew. There is another striking concordance between the two descriptions. The skin of his captors, McMahon said, was like plastic, hard. Harder skin. The fingertips felt more firm than ours. These fingertips had seized him by the arm. So he had a vivid sense of their firmness. Stephen Kilburn described the perfect fingers which touched him as he lay on the table as looking like hard plastic, and it feels hard. I don't know how he could possibly feel anything with a hard finger like that. Each witness not only made the same visual and tactile observations but also reported them in identical language. Harry Lynn had been interviewing witnesses until the last weeks of January, assembling videotape from NBC's archives, and searching for what he hoped would be the central image of his documentary, the filming of an abductee undergoing hypnosis. One can imagine that if only a small percentage of witnesses are willing to try hypnosis in the first place, how few of these would agree to do so on camera. The shooting could be arranged so that the witness's face would not be seen, Harry explained, but we all understood the difficulty of finding a willing subject. Stephen Kilburn had had, by this time, 2 hypnotic sessions, the first, with Dr. Franklin on May 11, 1978, and the second with Dr. Claymore on December 1. I asked him if he would consider the idea of a third session to be recorded by the NBC cameras, and he agreed to think it over. Soon thereafter he talked with Harry at his Rockefeller Center office, and was introduced to Chuck Scarborough, the newsman who would introduce and narrate the documentary. Within the week, after receiving Harry's firm assurances of anonymity, he agreed to the proposal. On Thursday afternoon, February 1, Dr. Claymore's apartment and office was invaded by camera, sound, and lighting technicians who transformed her living room into a mini studio. For various reasons, everyone was a little nervous. Aphrodite, of course, was the only person whose identity would be known, and she would also appear on camera. Shots of Stephen would focus on his hands which lay folded on his chest. His face would remain in shadow. None of the technicians had ever filmed or observed anything remotely like what they saw that afternoon. A normal, intelligent man in a deep hypnotic trance reliving his capture by the occupants of a UFO. What emerges from regressive hypnosis is always unpredictable, depending as it does on the subject's willingness to re-experience possibly traumatic events. Having committed his employer's resources rather formidably, Harry Lynn was more than merely looking forward to the afternoon's results. I myself am always uneasy at the beginning of a hypnotic session, as the reader will have gathered by now. So ironically, the only person who appeared relatively calm was Stephen Kilburn. Entering into a trance state meant that he was escaping from the pressures of current reality and traveling back into time, into those different pressures of a night in 1973. Dr. Claymore set the scene, leading him slowly back to Maryland and the 50-minute drive home from his girlfriend's house. She asks him to look at his watch. It is 3:05. He is sleepy, but he is afraid to stop and rest. I don't want to do that. Don't stop me. His respiration quickens. Something will happen if I stop. Okay, then, Dr. Claymore says softly, you keep right on driving. Stephen's voice is tense. I'm afraid to stop. I thought it would happen if I should stop. She asks him what he is going to do. Get home, as fast as I can. His voice is suddenly urgent. Something's in back of me, it's in the sky in back of me, and it's low and I can see it in the rear view mirror. There is a long pause. It's gone. I don't see it. Dr. Claymore asks him what happened. I'm afraid to think about it. I don't know. It's just gone. It was really low, just above the trees, and I go fast. I hit the gas. I go even faster than I was before. After a long pause, Dr. Claymore asks Stephen what's happening now. I'm trying, 125, not to think about it. I'm just driving, going home. The thing scared me, though. It kind of felt like, it's happening. It's happening and I knew it would. I mean, I almost knew what to expect. I don't know why. It scared me, but I don't really think it surprised me. She asks if he has ever seen anything like this before. I don't think so. Not that I remember. It was quiet. I had the windows up, so maybe it made noise, but I didn't hear anything. It just came up suddenly, really fast, with no noise, and then was gone. It's dark outside, so I don't know. After another long pause, Dr. Claymore asks again what's happening, and Stephen says he's almost home. It's almost light out. I'm kind of worried about whether I'm going to wake up my parents. I think it is light out. Yeah, it's pretty early in the morning. Again, she asks him to look at his watch, check the time, and he answers with the precision one encounters so often in hypnotic regression. I didn't look at my watch. There's a clock on top of my mother's refrigerator, and it's 5:07. The trip is supposed to have taken less than an hour. I don't know what happened to all the time, so I tiptoed into my house and went to bed. Dr. Claymore says that he seems upset, and she asks what's happening. What am I going to do about the time? It's missing. The existence of the 1, 2, 2 our time lapse leads Drive Claymore to her next question. Would you like to go over that ride again and see if something got left out? Once more, Stephen sets out from Frederick, Maryland, on US Route 40. He sees the UFO approach and pass over. Then his car is suddenly pulled off the road. He is deeply frightened. He gets out and stands near the front door, watching two dark things crouched near the fence. I'm afraid to look there. I'm really afraid to look there. I don't have any weapons or anything. They're coming. I go to my glove compartment and it's, a flashlight. Oh, a flashlight. Maybe I can use that to hit something. Agitated, and it's standing there, just looking at me. Not those things behind the fence. I can't do anything with the flashlight. My hands are still. I can't move. I can't take one little step. They know it, too. God, what is it? Jesus. There's another one coming now. There are 5 of them, and they are Jesus. Arms are really skinny. The head is really big, and the eyes are completely black, and they shine just a little bit from the reflection. There is a nose, like a tiny, little raised ridge and 2 little holes, like little pinholes. They're just checking me out. I can't move, though. I'm on my feet, but I am relaxed. My hands are at my sides and I'm completely, can't move at all. Can't even turn around. Stephen continues with his description of the figures. Until he pauses and Dr. Claymar asks him if he is still paralyzed. Not as much. I can move my head. I can't move my arms, though, at all. Then she asks, what happened to your arms that they can't be moved? There's just no strength in them. They don't hurt. I just don't have any muscles. It's almost like I have no will to do the things I want to do. I think I'd be almost afraid to move anyway, though. Next, Stephen describes the clamp on his shoulder. It hurts my back. It's twisting me. Jesus. Give me a break. I'll turn. Laughs nervously. Just ask me to turn. I'll turn. Oh. Oh no. Labored breathing. No. It's there. Next to my car. The thing I saw. The thing I saw in my windshield, and it's just sitting there, this thing, and the light coming from it. I think they are spotlights or something. Really bright. I can hardly see it. And this thing is extending from it, like a big, like a, boom. It's a tool or something to turn me around. And it's locked on my shoulder. I still can't move, so I don't know why they had to do that. My back, it bends my stomach out, and my shoulder back. Back hurts from it. Really hurts. Getting a little angry. They don't have to do that. I'm thinking that I wouldn't hurt them. They shouldn't hurt me. Shortly thereafter, we decided to bring the session to a close, so Dr. Claymar made a new request. Stephen, suppose you get back into the car. Can you do that? If I forget about them. All right. Let's just erase them from your mind. Erase that scene from your mind and get back into the car. Okay. You back in? I'm on the road on my way home. Good. Let yourself arrive at your parents' home. With great relief in the voice, I'm already there. Within a few moments, Dr. Claymar brought him out of the trance and the filming ended. It was impossible to know, looking from face to face, what the NBC technicians were thinking, but there was no mystery so far as Harry Lynn was concerned. He knew that he had captured many minutes of dramatic footage. When the completed documentary was shown 12 days later, its high points came during Stephen's hour with Dr. Claymar. The entire traumatic episode was covered by carefully selected excerpts from the hypnotic session. The unsteadiness of Stephen's voice, the irregularity of his breathing, and the fearful tension in his hands were all too obvious on the screen. Harry Lynn had filmed another interview with Stephen the day after his hypnosis. This time, he was alert and fully conscious as he expanded upon his recollections. In a funny kind of way, I felt physically much larger than they. I felt like I weighed 3 times as much as these things. But I was far inferior. I just felt that. And I don't know why. It was just a feeling they gave me. I got the feeling that if they would have wanted to communicate with me, they could have easily. But they weren't really that interested. I think they were being very analytical. I think this is why I was afraid of them. Because I really felt that, if one of them had wanted to look inside my body, and they would have had to cut me open to do it, and it would have hurt me intensely, they would have done it. Not to hurt me, but just to do what they were trying to do. And if it had killed me, well, they weren't trying to be mean or vicious. I think they were just out to do their job and that was it. Stephen continued, what frightens me, and what really frightens me is that because I didn't remember this before I underwent hypnosis, and now remember it, this could have happened to you. I think this has happened to a lot of people. And I don't mean 10 or 20, I mean thousands. Stephen's unsettling observation was followed by a bit of theoretical underpinning. Astrophysicist Robert Jastrow on the subject of life outside our solar system. If I hold my hand up to the sky like that, it conceals a part of the universe, and behind that hand there lie no less than 1,000 trillion stars and planets like the Earth. But within the visible universe, I think it would be extremely egotistical to think that the only intelligent life in that vast universe is right here on Earth. We are teeming with life in this world, and in that world of life, man and his entire planet are newcomers, our recent arrivals, not at the summit of creation, but somewhere near the bottom of the heap. Stephen's words ended the program. If anything happened to me, it could happen to you, let me put it that way. Dash, dash.